You're listening to Friendly Connections, the podcast of the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. I'm Chase Maxwell. This episode features the third installment of Visions of Courage, the second year of our Women's History Lecture Series, presented by historian Jill Zahneiser. This year, we're providing the entire series as a podcast, so stay tuned for the next episode. You can listen to these episodes on thefriends.org/podcast or on iTunes. Jill Zahneiser is an independent scholar who holds a PhD from the University of Iowa. She has taught at the Universities of Iowa and Minnesota, St. Cloud State University, and the University of Wisconsin River Falls. Dr. Zahneiser is the co-author of the recent book, Alice Paul Claiming Power, and author of the And Then She Said series of quotations by women. In this episode, Professor Zahneiser discusses the women's liberation movement of the 1970s. 50 years after women won the vote, a wide diversity of women began to advocate for equality under the law in public and private life. Initially ridiculed, Women's Lib ended up remaking America. Throughout the presentation, Professor Zahneiser refers to a series of visuals included in a PowerPoint presentation. This presentation and a suggested reading list is available to view on thefriends.org/courage. We encourage you to download these visuals before listening. Thank you for listening to Friendly Connections. Without any further ado, here's the third episode of Visions of Courage.
Thank you, Bailey. I am a member of the Friends and have been for many years, so I highly recommend it. And I think they didn't pay me to say that. I think that it's because we have such a strong Friends organization that the St. Paul Library is in as good shape as it is in terms of materials and in terms of the hours that they're open. City Council is always fighting about that, you know, every year. So Friends are always there. I was thinking about Halloween coming up on the way over and thinking that if we were in 1970, I suspect some small child would be thinking of getting a costume to go out as a women's libber. I suspect that was a popular costume in 1970. Not so much anymore. I remember I started teaching in 1972. My first years of teaching, I had the experience that many young women in that era had. They became feminists because of what happened to them in the workplace. But I remember that you dreaded somebody coming up and saying to you, "Are you one of those women's libbers?" You really did not want to hear that. You're remembering that too. So we're beyond those days, but tonight we're going to talk about the women's movement that emerged again in the late 1960s and 1970s. We can't talk about all the iterations of it, which have sort of come up to the present day, but I'll give you a sense of why it happened, when it happened, and a little bit about what it was all about, and we can talk about some of the things that are happening these days that connect back to the women's movement, if you like. We talked last week about what happened in Minnesota in terms of the women's suffrage movement, which by the 1960 is 40 years in the past. Very few suffragists lived beyond the 1940s. But we can talk about a little bit how those two movements are connected. Rather than seeing them, as you hear in many accounts, as a first wave women's movement and a second wave women's movement, they're maybe better seen, and you can see them as waves, but you know, waves sort of go like this, and there's high points and low points. And what we call the first and second waves are high points. We may, at this point, as we have people like Beyoncé and Taylor Swift declaring themselves feminist these days, we may be on the verge of a third wave after a fairly dry period, I would say. So, entitled Sisterhood is Again Powerful, talking about the women's movement of the 1960s and 70s. First of all, for those of you that are old enough, for those of you that are not, it was quite a crazy era. 1960s and early 1970s. The civil rights movement was in full swing by 1960 when students in Greensboro, North Carolina, sat down at a lunch counter wanting to be served. Rosa Parks had already sat down on the bus. The Montgomery bus strike had already happened before that. Civil rights leader Medgar Evers is assassinated in 63. The March on Washington, the I Have a Dream speech, happened in August of 1963. Of course, JFK is assassinated a few months later, the Vietnam War, the anti-war movement, the new left that we're going to be talking about, the assassinations of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy. What you see behind this slide, the photo is the famous Kent State picture where four students were killed. The voting age is lowered, partly because of the Vietnam War and the student movement there, lowered from 21 to 18 in 1971. Watergate opens the 1970s, and we could maybe, the 1960s maybe ends when Mr. Nixon resigns in 1974. So all of those things happened, and we haven't even talked about the women's movement. So for those of you that lived through that, you know there was a heck of a lot of stuff going on and a lot of craziness, a lot of tumult and turmoil in this era. So that is the backdrop for what we're talking about. The significance of the women's movement of the late 1960s and 70s, and which comes on into today, the women's movement that arose then had much broader goals than the suffrage movement. The suffrage movement did not have the vote as its only goal. They were working on other kinds of legal equality as well. But the women's movement that arose in the late 20th century was dipping into the notion of private life, equality in private life, and the whole ideas of what women are and what men are and how whether women and men are the same, whether they're different, and if they're different, why are they different? Are they really the same underneath? You know, what the source of all of those differences that we perceive are. The idea that women and men are made, not born. And with the transgender movement these days, we're much further along with that idea, obviously. The impact of the women's movement, as we look back, 40 years, can be seen in almost every aspect of American life. I would be hard-pressed to find an area of American life that the ideas of the women's movement have not touched in one way or another. And of course, the women's movement was inspired itself by the women's suffrage movement and the civil rights movement. But I think as a social movement, the depth of the ideas, the fact that they were dealing with the very fundamentals of our society made them really the foundation, the inspiration for all kinds of later social movements. Not only the movements that directly arose with black women, Chicanas, Asian women, sort of offshooting their own separate aspects of the women's movement, but then we have the disabled people's movement, homosexual, gay rights, and now transgender. And others probably that I'm forgetting. So, and all of these movements were taking a lot of the ideas that the women's movement had articulated as really the basis for their own social movement. So I think as an inspirational movement, it is more far-reaching than either civil rights and certainly than the women's suffrage movement. So the significance, I think, is tremendous when we look back from this vantage point. There are some commonalities between the march for the vote, the battle for the ballot, as they call it, and what most people knew as the women's liberation movement, even though it was kind of two movements together. One commonality is that ideas were wellsprings for the movement. The women's suffrage movement perhaps began with Mary Wollstonecraft's A Vindication of the Rights of Women, published in 1792, which stressed the need move towards the idea of women's equality by stressing women's education and that we could not entrust women to bring up our children if we weren't educating them in some very basic ways. That really is the beginning of the women's suffrage movement. In 1949, Simone de Beauvoir, a French woman, published a book called The Second Sex. It was briefly a bestseller. It didn't get a tremendous amount of attention at the time, but 10 years later, it began to get a lot of attention. She is the one that really articulated the idea that women are made, society makes women, women are not born. And we'll talk more about that. And then most of you probably are aware that The Feminine Mystique, coming out in 1963 by Betty Friedan, is one of the books that are seen as inspiring the women's movement of the 1960s. Both movements happened in eras that were rapidly changing. The suffrage movement happened, really picked up steam in the progressive era when all kinds of reforms were being suggested, when trade union activity was very, very strong. The Settlement House movement pushes against the inequality that's similar to what we see today between the rich and the poor, trying to address that gap, inequality gap between the rich and the poor. So lots of other things happening in both eras, and the things that I mentioned on the earlier slide happening in the 60s and the 70s. So these movements emerged when a lot of other things that were not unrelated were going on as well. Also, at both times, we have a critical mass of women. If you remember, we talked about, for the women's suffrage movement, we had many, many more women moving into higher education, many, many more women moving into jobs of some type, in industrial factories, in office work, as we invent the typewriter and other kinds of office machines. In the 60s and the 70s, these are young women, not necessarily a higher percentage than were going to college 50 years ago, but in terms of numbers, because of the increase of population, many, many more in terms of numbers. So we had a critical mass of women there, and we had many, many more women, a higher percentage of women in the workforce or aspirational to the workforce. So again, a critical mass of women. And then one author, one of the books on your reading list, Christine Stansel, her recent sort of survey of women's history, talks about there being mother-daughter splits in both movements. And that's the idea that, she talks about the idea that the split between Nossa and Alice Paul, who was we talked about being the militant leader who sent the pickets in front of the White House, was very confrontational. That's kind of the daughter's end of the movement. That's, you know, let's shake things up a little. Let's go out and do something new. Those are the daughters in the movement. The mothers are the ones, okay, let's just do this. You know, we don't want to shake things up. We want to do this in a very organized fashion. We want to make sure we have our ducks in the row. That's kind of the mother's end of a social movement. So she characterizes both of these movements as having mother's wings and daughter's wings. And there's a sense of familial ties there, as well as there is some enmity between both wings of the women's movement in both times. So not everyone likes that characterization, but it's undeniable that there were two aspects of both the women's suffrage movement and the women's liberation movement. So those are the commonalities. Now let's talk about how we get from the women's suffrage movement to the women's liberation movement. After, we talked briefly last time, what happens after women get the vote? And someone asked the question about, you know, did women vote any differently than men did? And this was part of what was a little bit of a disappointment for suffragists and women who had worked in a variety of social reforms after 1920, that we didn't see, you know, women rushing to the polls, some women who, you know, really didn't care about voting. In general, we see, in the beginning of the 20th century, we see the percentage of people that are going out to vote declining for a variety of reasons having to do with how political parties were operating at that time. So women were not any different than men in that regard, that they were viewing voting in a somewhat different way than people had in the 19th century. But we find women voting in about the same numbers, and there not being any significant gender gap, a word that we would not come to know, a phrase that would not be coined until 50 years later. So that was a little bit of a disappointment. There's also, after World War I, although the war had not been fought on our own soil, of course, but there had been tremendous home front participation. There had been a lot of dissent and a lot of tumult associated with that war on the home front. A lot of people went to jail for dissenting, objecting to the war. So there was, after any war, and we find this after World War II as well, there's a sense of, oh boy, you know, it's over, now we can get back to real life. So there's this sense for a lot of people that, you know, we just kind of want to get back to what we've been doing and enjoy our everyday life. So that's kind of a natural thing. And so when we think of the 20s and we think of flappers and we think of, you know, of course we have Prohibition going on at this time, but we, you know, we think of when we see movies about the 20s, everybody's having a party and having illegal booze and dancing and all those kinds of things. So that's a reflection. Not everybody was doing that, but that's a reflection of that sense of wanting to get back to a personal life, wanting to get to enjoy peace, and wanting to enjoy a brief period in the early 1920s of prosperity. The main suffrage organization becomes the League of Women Voters in 1920, and they continue with a wide, very broad program of social reform. The National Woman's Party, headed by Alice Paul, persists as the National Woman's Party. While the League of Women Voters continues on essentially working women's legislation, and they come up with a group called the Joint Congressional Committee, continue to lobby Congress, and find some successes in terms of advances for working women in the 1920s. The National Woman's Party and Alice Paul come up with something that we now know as the Equal Rights Amendment. In 1923, that is written, and they begin to lobby for that. As we know, not much happens with that until the second part of the women's movement. So that begins in the 1920s. So these groups, the hardcore suffragists who were really committed to working on reforms having to do with improving women's lives, a small group of these people continue to work because that is their life. And they continue to work through the 20s and into the 30s. By the 1940s, most of them are gone, not all of them. But during the suffrage movement, Eleanor Roosevelt was, of course, alive. She was living in Washington during the last years of the suffrage movement. She was a young bride, however, did not need to work. Her husband had a very nice job as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, if you might remember. And she really was not involved with social reform yet. When FDR begins to go into political life, elected political life, and is elected governor of New York, she gets into reform work. And she begins to assemble, really, a group of women who have been involved in reform work for a long time, women like Frances Perkins, who eventually becomes the first female cabinet member, a Secretary of Labor in the New Deal. And by the time FDR is elected president, she has this group around her, and they and she are able to influence FDR. So we do see some what could be called feminist activity in the New Deal, with a number of women being engaged in one way or another in New Deal programs. Women like Molly Dewson is one name, Margaret DeWalt from the National Woman's Party. Most of these people were not from the National Woman's Party. They were sort of still off to the side. So we do have some successes in the New Deal that we could call feminist successes. Social Security, considered by this group of women as a big success for them. Because who's drawing Social Security? It's mostly women, right? Because women are the ones that are living long. So Social Security is considered a New Deal success. Eleanor Roosevelt and the group around her work long and hard to try to get women workers included in some of the emergency relief acts. So they are engaged not in a way that's terribly visible, but in a way that is really bringing improvement in a lot of women's lives. There's also increasing activity among union women. Women are welcomed into unions much more so than they were in the early part of the century, and we see union women, again, working on small improvements in working women's lives. Pictured here is Eleanor Roosevelt and Mary McLeod Bethune, who had worked on reform, particularly in the educational arena. For a long time, she founded in the mid-1930s the National Council of Negro Women, and she was one of the most influential women in FDR's administration because she becomes a member of what is called the Black Cabinet, who are advisors that are not terribly visible but are well known and whom FDR called in on a regular basis to advise him on some of the programs that he was considering. And Mary McLeod Bethune, thanks to Eleanor Roosevelt's connection with her, becomes one of those advisors. So even though we think that there's not a whole lot visible happening in terms of feminist movement, after 1920. We have women continuing to work on advances and things actually happening. And the same thing is really happening with civil rights. We have legal cases being brought. Thurgood Marshall gets involved in the 1940s, for example. Things that aren't terribly visible, we don't know, that don't appear in the history books very much unless you're getting into something that's very specific. But yet there was activity that was persistent and a group of people that were carrying forth these ideas. Eleanor Roosevelt gets involved with one woman who is one of the union women who has worked for a long time, she and her husband, in union activity. And that is a woman named Esther Peterson. And she is one of the women in 1948, after the UN has, the new United Nations, has established a commission on the status of women. In 1948, she calls for a US commission on the status of women. Remember that. In the 1950s, we think, oh, not much was happening. But actually, quite a bit was happening. World War II brings a lot of women into the workforce. Why are they going to work? Because the men are off at war. Women are needed to fill those slots. Those were good slots. Those jobs working on the airplanes, some of those industrial jobs, those were good jobs. And women who had been engaged in those jobs and enjoying them were essentially told when military came back after the war, you know, go home and do your thing. Some women really liked working. They decided they liked working. They had this work experience, and they wanted to continue working. So not everybody went back home. Some people continued to think about some sort of career ahead for them. My own mother was one of these women. She had trained as a nurse, went to 2 years of college in order to be a registered nurse, and started working at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. During the war, met my father shortly after the war, and they got married, and she stopped working. Very, very typical kind of thing. So she had this work experience during the war and never really forgot it. Here she is, a trained professional. So even though my father was not a fan of married women working, after her children, three of us, were in school, she insisted on going back to work as a nurse. That came in handy several times in their and my family life. So she, I think, is very typical of women who kind of had a taste of what it was to have a job that was fulfilling during the war. And like my mother, they might not have pressed to continue working. Some of them did. Some of them, like her, might have gotten married and then waited, but they then go back to work. And you can see here in this chart, two things are charted here. One is the actual labor force participation starting in 1930. We don't have a very high percentage of women working. Most of those women are single women or they're minority women. These are the women who have to work. We see this line kind of rising a bit suspiciously in 1940 as the war is starting, dipping down just about the time the war is ending, a significant dip, but then a very steady rise through the 1950s and 1960s. So belying the notion that everybody, just all the women who were working, just went home after the war, a lot of women stayed in one way or another in the workforce. Look also at the, we're looking at this line here. Should a married woman work? This is the suspicious dip. After the war, we're thinking, okay, don't think women should work, but then being educated like my father in the virtues of married women working, we see that line pretty steadily go up as working married women's participation and all women's participation in the workforce goes up steadily through the 1950s and then more sharply after 1970s. Other things happening in the 1950s, again, the numbers of women in college, many, many more, even though the percentage was actually not higher than those 50 years before. The beginning of the civil rights movement, 1956, Rosa Parks this is not the first civil rights action, but the one that really captured the national imagination and the one that is seen as the spark for the larger movement, one that captured the attention. And then finally, Esther Peterson, who has been waiting since 1948 for a commission on the status of women, ends up being assigned from one of her jobs to lobby a senator named John Fitzgerald Kennedy, who is later elected president. And she is able to convince him in 1961 to establish the United States Commission, or the Presidential Commission, on the Status of Women. And here we see him signing in October 1963, so one of his final acts, the report that is done from the commission staff on the status of women in the United States in 1963. And Esther Peterson is right here, one of the women on the commission who had been involved with the commission report. Polly Murray, who was on the staff, was an African-American lawyer who had had a heck of a time getting a job as an African-American woman with a law degree, was unable to find a job, ends up on one of the committees specifically investigating the law for the commission, and she says, this is where we began to discover all of this horrible sexism in the law. And indeed, the report that John F. Kennedy is signing talks about women as an underutilized resource and documented all kinds of discrimination that women were facing in work situations, in Social Security, in jury service, in obviously in the percentage of public officials, and also in child care, the availability of child care. The commission recommended that the government open opportunities for women to encourage them to take paid work and this is very interesting, to bring recognition and compensation, money, to women who were full-time homemakers. This is an idea that was not the first suggestion that full-time homemaking was a job that maybe should be compensated. Not the first and not the last, and you probably don't need me to tell you how far we've come in compensating full-time homemakers. But that was one of the things that was suggested, and the report says indicated that we shouldn't be thinking about homemakers as dependent, women who were dependent on their husband, that in fact they were contributing equally to the marriage because they were taking care of all these things in an unpaid fashion. So I think those ideas are probably acknowledged these days. The pay, however, has been a long time coming. They recommended that child care be publicly funded, an idea whose time has still not come. They recommended income guarantees for pregnant women and unemployed women, equal employment policies for any company taking federal funds, and they supported the Equal Rights Amendment, an idea whose time seemed like it had come by 1963. But they talked about getting the Equal Rights Amendment through the 14th Amendment, which had guaranteed equal protection for all citizens under the law. That's been a strategy that's been tried by women to get somewhere a couple different times. So we have this massive report that's documenting all kinds of discrimination for women in practically every area that you can think of, by, you know, signed by the president and coming out with women that were, you know, very respectable, mature women. And this is 1963 into the American public. The same year, as you can see, the year's most controversial bestseller comes out called The Feminine Mystique. Here's Betty Friedan, who was a journalist and homemaker in 1963. She's really writing about herself here and talking about a lot of women like herself who were college educated and yet and had anticipated some kind of career for themselves, but found themselves at home in the suburbs, raising children, and not really having much intellectual stimulation. She called that the problem with no name. The problem with no name. And people bought this book and started wondering why, a lot of women started wondering why they hadn't thought about this before as a group problem rather than an individual problem. It wasn't just them. It wasn't just an individual woman that felt unhappy or unfulfilled. There were more women like those individuals out there, like Betty Friedan. So a lot of women were seeing themselves in this book. So there wasn't any really visible response to this book initially, but it is something that was roiling underneath the surface in addition to this big commission report that would eventually make a difference. A couple years later, the Commission on the Status of Women is rather frustrated rather frustrated because they have been successful in getting a Civil Rights Act passed, and part of the Civil Rights Act, which prohibited job discrimination on the basis of race, they succeeded in getting Title VII, which prohibited discrimination in employment on the basis of sex. Looked like a kind of a visible move ahead. However, the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, was not really given any enforcement power. And a couple years later, the women on the commission get very frustrated with the fact that this is in the law, and yet it's not being enforced. Why is that? So in their frustration, they found an organization called the National Organization for Women, known as NOW, still with us. This is their founding meeting. Here's Betty Friedan, one of the founders, on the right here. Here's Pauli Murray, kind of in the back here, also one of the founders of NOW. And they determined to put some pressure on the government to start enforcing what is now in the law. They're modeling themselves after the NAACP, focusing on legal, working towards legal equality in sort of an accepted way that people have tried to get laws passed for years and years in the United States. Friedan becomes the first president. There's a little bit of an irony with Title VII and the EEOC in that the what was called protective legislation, laws that were on the books for years that so-called protected working women from not having to work too many hours or from pregnant women not having to work really at all. A number of things that were seen as protecting women because they were the weaker sex. Those laws become the first laws that are invalidated by Title VII and the EEOC. Vindicating Miss Alice Paul, who had insisted that the Equal Rights Amendment was the way to go rather than this protective legislation, but overturning things that people like Esther Peterson had worked for years. So a little bit of an irony there. NOW has its own legal staff, like the NAACP had its own legal staff. Thurgood Marshall was part of the NAACP's legal staff. Their first lawsuit is against people, against airlines on behalf of people they used to call stewardesses, claiming that stewardesses were discriminated against on the basis of sex for a variety of reasons that we don't need to go into, but you can imagine. Other groups, similar groups, are organized about the same time. The National Women's Political Caucus, focused on more on Congress than a lawsuits. A group named 9 to 5, which was specifically an association of working women rather than professional women. And WEAL, W-E-A-L, which was the Women's Equity Action League. All of these sort of in the reformist vein, trying to move ahead on policies or making lawsuits in order to advance the equality of women. So NOW gets founded in 1966. Gloria Steinem, who is now in the news again, here she is in her 70s, coming out with a new book and been interviewed and all of that. Here we see her as a young woman. Gloria Steinem in 1963, she is a journalist out of Ohio. She writes she goes to the Playboy Club. And she works as a bunny. And she writes an article called A Bunny's Tale. This has been made into a TV movie with Kirstie Alley some years ago. And she finds after she writes this bunny tale, which is in a New York magazine, she can't find a job because people no longer think she's a credible journalist. So this is her kind of feminizing experience. And a few years later, she is finding some work. She goes to a rally on abortion. And when women are talking about the fact that they've had abortions, and this is before Roe v. Wade is passed, and Gloria Steinem, and she talks about this in her new book, I guess, she had, in fact, had an abortion, and she feels compelled to speak out at this meeting about how frustrated she was about the circumstances in which she had to have this abortion because it was illegal at that time. So she has these radicalizing experiences for herself. Because she is a young, attractive woman, and she also has the pen And she is hired by, gets hired by New York Magazine and others, and she gets involved in these activities. She becomes seen by the mass media as the leader of the women's movement. She always denies, has been denying this for years, in fact. But the popular perception is Gloria Steinem is the leader of the women's movement. She will tell you that is far from the case. There really is no leader because there are so many different organizations. She goes on to found a magazine by and for women called Ms. This is a copy of the first issue. Still out there, although it's come and gone several times. But they start to publish a magazine for women that is very different from any women's magazine you have ever picked up, particularly in that it is very, very careful about the advertising that it carries. It's dramatically different in that fashion. So Gloria Steinem, again, still with us. One of the things that NOW does in these other organizations like the National Women's Political Caucus is discover the Equal Rights Amendment. The idea of going for the 14th Amendment, getting equal rights that way, is discarded. And the new feminists discover the old feminists, one of whom is still alive. Whoops, keep doing this. And that is Miss Alice Paul, seen here in the last years of her life. She dies in 1977. But not before the ERA has passed Congress and goes to the states to be ratified. The ERA is passed in 1972. It's given a 7-year deadline, as amendments are, constitutional amendments are, to be ratified. We see an ERA march here in 1978. 22 states ratified it the first year, which was very good progress. Then it got a lot slower. Minnesota ratified, does anyone know? 1973, not in the first 22, but a short time later, in the second. There were 13, including Minnesota, in the second year. Then it slowed down dramatically. As you may know, the ERA did not have the requisite number of states by the end of the deadline. It was given a 3-year extension, at which time the opposition brought out its troops in a major way, and we're still waiting for the ERA. There's a lot of controversy, however, about the ERA and whether that is the correct strategy. A lot of people think it would just be endless lawsuits because in and of itself, it would not make anything that was unequal go away. You would have to go into the court on everything in order to make things equal. Other people say, well, because it's in the Constitution, therefore a lot of people would change their policies, their laws, because they know that they would be overturned if a lawsuit was brought against them. So, still controversial. Some people thought perhaps with Mr. Obama it would advance a little. It keeps being introduced into Congress. It has not advanced. So I guess we're waiting for perhaps the first female president. So NOW organizes in 1966, but there's something else going on. And that is what we then called the New Left, the student movement, the anti-war movement, and also the civil rights movement. And young people who are in college or just out of college have been involved with both of these movements since the early 1960s. Through the 60s, particularly young white women see a lot of both young and older black women as role models because they are doing some of the hardest work of the civil rights organizing particularly SNCC, one of the newer civil rights organizations. And they are sort of relegated to clerical tasks and housekeeping tasks, and they get very frustrated with this. Same thing happens within the New Left, this student movement, the anti-war movement. They find themselves kind of relegated to the housekeeping tasks, the clerical tasks, not really given voice very much. They try to make changes in these organizations, speak up, they don't get anywhere. They get very frustrated and walk out in 1967 and begin developing their own group. Now, the student movement, the anti-war movement, civil rights movement, very big on alternative institutions. They were not really, unlike NOW, interested in reforming American society. They were really interested in rebuilding it from the ground up. Now, that may seem silly to you, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. It was, I think, a time when a lot of people who were that age, and include myself in that, it was a very idealistic time, I think. There was a sense that so much was changing, that so much more could change, and that all of that was in the realm of possibility. Remember, the greatest generation had brought up this generation. We had a very prosperous 50s, so we had a generation of young people who were very well taken care of, who had experienced only prosperity, and had a sense that they could do anything, at least the young men did at that time. And I remember my father saying to me, when I was in about sixth grade, he said, you could be a teacher, you could be a nurse, or you could be a teacher of nurses. And I thought that was great. I didn't think anything about that in terms of it being limiting. And that's what a lot of women my age heard. So a generation who saw the civil rights movement, was very supportive of that, saw the war, and wanted to change what was going on there. There's a sense of idealism and a sense that things could be changed. So a lot of the things that seemed kind of silly in retrospect, to them, seemed like something that was possible. Anything was possible then. So they begin, the civil rights movement, the New Left, had begun developing all kinds of alternative institutions, their own newspapers, freedom schools, their teach-ins, all kinds of ways to begin really what they called pockets of power in the society and begin building a new society. So when the young women, particularly young white women, left the New Left and civil rights movements in 1967, this is where they went naturally. They didn't go to change laws. They thought, that's the old way of doing things. We're going to begin a new society. And so they began their own alternative institutions. Now, they were criticized by the mothers in NOW and by historians also for this very decentralized approach. Who is your leader? We don't have a leader. You know, we don't have a leader in our group. We're non-hierarchical. We're building a new society. That may sound naive, and in some ways it was, but they were taking that approach. And so in that sense, there was a split. They had the same idea that they wanted greater equality, but they were going about it in a very different way. Initially, there is not much interaction between the groups. There gets to be a little bit more fluidity later on. One of the best known protests, and there's a lot of guerrilla theater and a lot of the sort of things that Alice Paul would have liked in her younger days, sort of take it out to the streets kind of politicizing. One of the most famous was the 1968 Miss America pageant protest, and we see the young woman holding the sign, "Welcome to the Miss America cattle auction," talking about women as sex objects, women being paraded around for their bodies. This poster says, "Break the dull steak habit," and has a woman sort of carved up or ready to be carved up into various cuts of meat. Women were considered just like a cut of meat, looked at like that. This is one of the most famous ones. This is where the term bra burners comes from. The women at this protest threw what they considered to be the emblems of their inequality, things that were holding them back and holding them in, literally. They were throwing them into a freedom trash can. That included brassieres, girdles, stockings, things like that. There's no indication that anything was ever burned, but somehow the term bra burner became something that the media picked up, and the young women like this, who were eventually called women's liberationists or women's libbers, were always, the alternative name for them was bra burners. One of them makes it onto Time magazine in 1970, getting a little attention. Kate Millett, who I believe now has died, but she was one of the early theorists, comes out with a book called Sexual Politics. And she has gone back to Simone de Beauvoir and dug into this idea that women are not the weaker sex, they have been conditioned to be the weaker sex. That the society creates women and men in the traits that we consider them to have, they are not innate. So this question of what is nurture, what is nature, very much at the heart of the radical end of the women's movement. The idea that the personal is political, this is something they had brought in from the civil rights movement, from the New Left, the idea that if you are being discriminated against, it's not just you the individual. This is a society-wide problem. So if you get together with other people who are in similar situations, then you can make a change. A lot of women's liberationists, the idea of change was much more on a group level. They developed also as a result of organizing experiences they'd had in their earlier days. They developed something that was then called consciousness raising, where women would get together in a group and simply talk about the things that they felt were holding them back, finding their commonalities, finding out that the personal is political. It's not just your husband that's talking to you that way, but it's also all of these other people having similar experiences. And so that began to build an allegiance, to build a consciousness, as they were trying to do. But these two ideas very much at the heart of the radical end of the women's movement, and I think have been those that have the most staying power, very much with us today in terms of the way we're thinking about women. We have a counterculture building. Part of it is the radical end of the women's movement. Part of it is the hippies, who are another group of people who have left the New Left and sort of given up on politics and are doing their own thing in these alternative institutions. So there's some fluidity between these two groups as well, and there are also some New Left groups as well. But women start to create their own, as lesbians kind of begin to have a consciousness of their own, they create their own institutions in some cases. Our Bodies, Ourselves is probably one of the most famous books that comes out of this. The group was called the Boston Women's Health Book Collective. How many of you know Our Bodies, Ourselves? What I'm talking about? I think they're still operating. And you can see from the image that these things were essentially mimeographed. You know, there was no Xerox machines back then. So they begin to create their own materials, and they're mimeographing things and passing them around and mailing them to people. And this is how they begin to create a literature of their own. Our Bodies, Ourselves was the information that was created by this collective group of women. They began to say, you know, doctors who are all male have too much influence over this. We don't know our own bodies. We need to begin investigating our own bodies and taking charge of our own health. And the women's health movement really began there, and it's had really tremendous influence to this day. But they come out first with a book called Our Bodies, Ourselves, which was hugely popular and went into all kinds of other editions and has just sold millions and millions of copies and spawned a whole movement in that direction. There were all kinds of papers. This is one called The Furies, which is a lesbian feminist. Red Stockings was one of the more well-known groups. Most of the groups are in Boston, New York, also Chicago, though. Chicago had one of the strongest groups. And it's interesting, I was looking at some of the lists of the women involved in those groups, and a fair number of them now are either historians of women that are very well known or journalists or have continued to make careers for themselves in the same way. Twin Cities was not left behind here, folks. 1969, the Twin Cities Female Liberation Group forms, and there was a tremendous amount of, and again, there's fluidity between kind of the hippie culture, most of which was on the West Bank, the feminist culture, and some back and forth, but some sort of separate institutions. The most famous alternative institution, perhaps, is the Amazon bookstore, seen here in a later iteration, which happened really about the late 70s, I think, about 10 years after. If you're, those of you that know the Amazon bookstore, if you remember the one on 26th and around 26th and Hennepin, this is that bookstore. But it started in somebody's house. There was no literature to speak of. They had no sense of history of women. They really didn't even know about some of the things that had been written earlier. And they start creating. They start just digging into whatever they can themselves, into whatever materials they can find, and they create materials to pass around. So their bookstore was essentially a bunch of mimeographed things and maybe a couple copies of The Second Sex sitting there, and they built from that. And eventually, of course, it went through several stores and finally closed a couple years ago. Last location was on 48th in Chicago. This was one of the first feminist bookstores and one of the most long-lasting of the feminist bookstores. But there were bakeries, there were restaurants, there were the health The health institutions had a lot of people interested here. Red Star Herbs was one of the food. Some of you may remember all the food co-ops there used to be. Some of these were supplied by women's feminist institutions like Red Star Herbs. Women's Advocates, the shelter in St. Paul, that group goes back to the beginning here. They created the first shelter for battered women in the United States here in St. Paul. You may remember Chrysalis, Sigaris. These were both women's, psychology alternative institutions. So Minneapolis, St. Paul, very well represented. This is one of the lesbian publications that was here briefly. My dissertation was on four of these kinds of institutions, and I interviewed the founders of Amazon and what was then Red Star Herbs at the time. But one of the ones that I found at the time, and I copied this from my dissertation for you because I love the name, the Lesbian Inciter. Very clever. Theater, also very big. At the foot of the mountain, I think still around in some guise. At the Circle of the Witch was another theater group. The Warm Women's Art Registry started at this time, and of course still, again, in one form or another, is still with us. So you see the sense of just the broad kinds of different institutions that they were interested in, whether psychology, art, theater, of course newspapers, magazines, very, very big, as well as bookstores. So Twin Cities very well represented here. The two strands of the women's movement got together on a big protest in 1970, which was to celebrate something they had rediscovered, and that is the passage of the 19th Amendment in 1920. So they're celebrating the 50th anniversary of women getting the vote with a women's strike for equality. The theme of the day was "Don't iron while the strike is hot." August 26, which was when the 19th Amendment was ratified, this is the protest in New York City. And there was one here in Minneapolis, and they did some guerrilla theater kinds of things down Hennepin Avenue at that time. One estimate was 20,000 women across the country, 20,000 women across the country participating in that day. So from those kinds of numbers, you can get the sense, and the Time magazine we saw before, that the mainstream media and people in general are starting to pay some attention to these groups when you look at both strands combined. And one of the most interesting ways in which the mainstream culture took note was with the Battle of the Sexes, which some of you may remember got a huge amount of attention in 1973 when Billy King, who was a tennis star, not paid very much at the time, and Bobby Riggs, who was an older tennis star, decided to play each other to see whether men or women were the stronger on the court. So it was a grudge match, and the two of them both played this up for theater to the best of their ability. And as I recall, Bobby Riggs kind of came onto the court in this sort of carriage and this huge costume, and it was quite something. You see them shaking hands, but he sort of trash-talked her for a month before the event, and it was very, very big press. Do you know who won? She won. He later insisted on playing another woman, Margaret Court, who was a lesser player on the circuit at that time, and he did manage to beat her. Billie Jean King won that one. And lots of other ways that we begin to see things happening in the mainstream press. The Virginia Slims advertising campaign you're probably familiar with. It may still be going on. Well, they're not allowed to advertise anymore, I guess. But someone pictured in the cast of Mad Men, someone like that, someone like John Hamm, took the idea of taking something from women's past. In this, you can't really see it, but it talks about a woman sneaking a smoke when smoking was very scandalous for women. And then trying to sort of co-opt the women of the day by saying, you've come a long way. They hadn't added the baby yet. But trying to encourage them to smoke Virginia Slims. And Virginia Slims was a sponsor of the tennis circuit for a while until we realized what that was about. But Ms. Magazine in 1972 starts picking up and sort of hitting back at this kind of advertising, and this actually is fairly positive compared with some of the advertising, like the what I should have brought in is one of the maiden form ads. I imagine myself in a maiden form underwear in Grand Central Station or something. Ad campaigns like that. Ms. Magazine insisted on reviewing their ads. They wouldn't let anybody advertise in their magazine unless it was, you know, by their standards. And they had ads constructed as well. And this is one of the most famous ones that I just love. Hire him, he's got great legs. And the text here is saying, if women thought this way about men, they'd be awfully silly. When men think this way about women, they're silly too. So although the women's movement was seen by many people as humorless, in fact, here they're using humor to try to make a point about how silly it is to hire people based on their looks. And the coda there, woman power, it's much too good to waste. So we see ways in which this movement is beginning to affect the larger culture, not just people sort of pointing at them, oh, isn't that silly, but beginning to incorporate the larger ideas. Of course, once you get popular in America, there's always a pushback. This is Phyllis Schlafly, still with us. Beginning in the 1970s was, you know, a longtime politico who excelled at telling people that feminism was going to destroy people like her who were full-time homemakers when she was not. But she really was spouting some very familiar arguments, arguments that had been used against women getting the vote 100 years before that or 50 years before that. But basically the idea is that, you know, women's nature is really not to be outside the home. Women's nature is to be in childcare, in cooking, in housework. This is what women do well. This is what they were created to do. And if we pass the ERA, which was one of her favorite targets, this will essentially destroy our society as we know it. And what people never, the question people never sort of ask about it is, how is it that the ERA, which is intended to at the legal level to promote legal equality, how is it that that suddenly becomes a private, something that happens in your private home, which was never part of the ERA. So, but she is still having quite a bit of success. And there were many others. So, and with the other things that are happening in the 1970s, you know, the economy kind of takes a downturn. And some of it is just certainly on the part of the younger women involved. Some of that is just growing up, getting married, having to get a job, having to support yourself, having a family. So a lot of the little groups that had formed weren't very long lasting. Some of them lasted longer than others, but we see sort of a retreat of sorts. The radical part of the movement really is not at all visible much after about 1973, but the ideas have taken hold, and we see them going into really every area of American life. The notion that it's okay to beat your wife or your husband, which was very much the case in the 1960s, no longer with us. Pornography aspect of the idea is, I think, a little more controversial, but still they've had some success with that. Sports, as the Billie Jean King, Bobby Riggs thing would suggest, a huge change in the number because of Title IX, mandating equality in the way women were treated in college and high school sports, tremendous difference in the participation of women in sports. And we're still sort of working up into the professional ranks. Of course, we have the Lynx here in the Twin Cities, one of the success stories in terms of professional women's sports. In education, not as many strides as you would think. I just saw something the other day about the number of the percentage of women getting computer science degrees having dropped about 20%. In the last 10 years. So some of these things are back and forth. There's been an explosion, of course, in women's studies, women's history particularly, as my presence here would suggest. and a lot of success, if not as much success as we might have wanted, in reforming a whole raft of discriminatory laws. Pregnancy Discrimination Act, we were just talking about ahead of the presentation, so that pregnant women are not sort of forced out of a job before they are ready to stop working. Paid maternity leave in many situations, one of the successes. The electoral successes, not as much as we might have liked. Women are now 20, I believe it is, in the Senate. Geraldine Ferraro in 1984, of course, tries to be vice president. We're still working on that 20 years later. But it's hard to underestimate the amount of change, even though it's been incremental, in the way our ideas have changed about the way women are treated and the way men are treated as well. I think what some men recognized very early on is that these kinds of advances for women also meant more freedom for men and advances for men in terms of being who they are as well. We have a person on my street who's a house husband. Those people were ridiculed 20 years ago. Now they seem to be accepted. But, you know, this is somebody who's very happy what he's doing and really a result of some of the ideas that the radical end of the women's movement began. Our last talk next week is about the impact of women from Mexico in Minnesota. So we're taking a turn into the contemporary vein. Thank you very much for coming. Have a cookie on your way out. And happy Halloween. Thank you.
You've been listening to Friendly Connections, the podcast of the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library. If you enjoyed this episode, consider supporting the Friends and its mission, stronger libraries for stronger communities. Visit thefriends.org for more information. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/friendsofsppl and on Twitter @thefriends. To get the latest episode of this podcast delivered seamlessly to your mobile device, subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. Thank you again for listening.